Here's coming up in 15 minutes. I'm going to launch into a couple of segments talking about my phenomenal trip to the 49th state, Alaska. I'd never been there before. And I came back from that 10-day excursion with probably 10 segments worth of stories and observations from an incredible state. So we'll get into those stories starting at 7:55 here in 15 minutes. But I wanted to do a prologue to the Alaska stories because I wanted to talk about bear attacks. That was front and center for me as we landed in Alaska and we were heading out on 10 days or so worth of exploring and lots of hiking. And I told you before that when I went to Montana, which is grizzly country, I was going to do some hiking and all the locals encouraged me to get bear spray. And I remember sitting at the bar the night I got there and I was eating dinner and talking to the bartender and I said, should I get bear spray? And he goes, well, it's a little expensive. It's $40 a canister. But put it this way, if you're confronted by a grizzly out there on one of your hikes, you would pay $40,000 for a can of bear spray at that moment.
Right. I don't even understand why he's saying that, hey, it's a little expensive.
Yeah.
To me, $40 does not sound expensive for bear spray.
No, it's not. It's a
I didn't think I'd say that this morning.
It's a potential lifesaver. You'd pay $40 for
yes.
it. So I'm reading up on how to handle a bear attack before and during the trip. And it's really confusing. You have different ways of handling attacks by different bears.
Once again, you know, this is my big platform. We need to standardize what we humans are supposed to do when confronted by wild animals.
Yes.
It needs to be the same for a shark and a bear and a cheetah.
Right. Yet, you have to know how to handle all these different bears, and then when the bear jumps out on the trail in front of you, you are supposed to be able to flip through all that knowledge quickly to the correct one.
Right.
That hopefully you've correctly identified, and then act on what you're told to do. So it's really confusing. Well, my literary companion on this trip was a book called Tip of the Iceberg, and it was recommended by Hawkeye, our next-door neighbor at KSCS, and it's written by Mark Adams, and it's a great book. It's his 3,000-mile journey around wild Alaska, the last great American frontier, and he followed an expedition circa 1900 that was commissioned to explore Alaska, and so he went modern day and took the same track. Well, he writes a chapter about bears, because he was going to be out in it. And so he did the same thing, and I'll read from the book here. He says, according to various sources of information I'd been collecting from the Park Service, the best strategy was to avoid bears altogether.
Oh, okay. I hate it when they say that.
Okay. This applies to both black bears and brown bears. Okay. Grizzly bears are a variety of brown bear that lives inland. Bears do not like to be surprised, so hikers are advised to make noise by clapping or attaching to their clothing the sorts of bells usually associated with sleigh rides and court jesters. Mother bears with cubs are especially ill-disposed towards unexpected visitors. Bears are curious and may want to check you out. Should you encounter one that is stationary, back away slowly. Though if the bear follows you, another brochure warned, stand your ground. Never run from a bear because you can move, because it can move at 35 miles per hour. It will happily chase you down like other prey animals.
Well, I had no idea bears were that fast.
Mm-hmm.
35.
Oh, yeah.
I was advised to keep in mind that bears often make bluff charges, sometimes coming within 10 feet of their adversary without making contact. If the bear does this, you're supposed to continue waving your arms and talking to the bear. Like, we could keep calm if the bear makes a bluff charge.
Who's your favorite team? Do you think somebody disrespected the star?
That'd be. He
writes, this is the moment one is supposed to whip out the bear spray. And if the bear isn't dissuaded by your flailing and oratory and aerosol Tabasco sauce and decides to attack you, well, a brown bear will typically stop attacking once it no longer feels threatened. We did say this was a brown bear, right? Because if it's a black bear, do not play dead.
No.
One of the more dramatic brochures advised, most black bear attacks are predatory. Fun fact, Black bears often have blonde, brown, or cinnamon-colored fur.
Oh, my goodness.
The easiest way to tell a black bear from a brown bear is the latter has a distinctive shoulder hump. I guess if you're attacked, you should calmly reach around the bear's neck and feel for the hump.
Yeah.
You're also supposed to fight back vigorously against a brown bear.
Mm.
If the attack is prolonged and the brown bear begins to feed on you.
Feed on you.
What I really needed
Nursing?
Was a checklist for determining the moment a bear ceases her defensive attack and commences tearing into your flesh with the intent of swallowing and digesting you. Ideally, it would be laminated. So then he says he asked the next morning at breakfast at the B&B he was staying at, people who were there and some locals who work there, what they thought about a bear attack and how to handle one. And so one woman says, my first day at work, I met a coworker with one arm. You can't exactly introduce yourself and say, nice to meet you. How'd you lose the arm? So I asked someone else and she told me, oh, that bear attack.
Oh,
like she'd been in a fender bender. I won't show you the picture of my buddy sent to one of his coworkers, but his face is ripped off, her husband said.
Oh, my gosh.
Spreading jam on a slice of toast. It's just like so matter of fact the way Alaskans talk about bear right. attacks. They sewed it back on, but only one eye works. You probably saw they just found a guy in Anchorage near dead. They thought he was a stabbing victim. The hospital up there had a doctor who's like the world's leading expert on bear attacks. He took one look at the guy in ER and said, this isn't a stabbing. This guy was mauled.
This is no bear accident.
Then the grandmotherly host came from the kitchen with a pot of fresh coffee, and she said, one time I was out hunting and I saw a grizzly knock down a tree and jump on it until it splintered. I thought, well, I guess I'm going to go hunt somewhere else today. And there's no use bringing a dog, because if the dog sees a grizzly, it'll turn tail and lead the bear right back to you. I like the old saying, bring a gun and someone slower than you. So he eventually, in this book, chapters later, encounters two black bears. And they come down and disrupt the camp.
It's a big bear.
And the guide that he's with, it's just two of them against two bears. The guide he's with says, stand real close to me. Let's raise our arms and make a lot of noise. We need to look like one larger being to the two bears. That would work to chase the bears back into the woods for about a minute, but then they would come back down, and they eventually, one time when they chased the bears into the woods, they had about a minute, and they just ran over there, grabbed as much gear as they could, got in their canoe, and paddled away.
See, I don't think the bear buys that that's one creature.
Yeah, they're bears, probably smarter.
Yes. Yeah. They're used to seeing living things. They're going to figure out that this is two different things that are trying to pull a really bad... choreographed one creature move.
I would think so too.
And some of those bears are so big, like that Kodiak bear that they have in Alaska.
Hey guys,
how do you really know how you would react? I mean, even if you're very well versed in all these procedures, when you see that thing, you would totally lose it.
Yeah, what we need to do is just standardize it to your response should be scream and urinate. If we do that, then everyone will follow directions.
Well, in my time in Alaska, did I encounter a bear?
Uh-oh.
Details next.
And Junior didn't take just any vacation. He went to Alaska.
I've always wanted to make this trip. I've always been fascinated by what Alaska might look like. And as you know, I'm a big map freak. So for my entire life, I've been looking at Alaska on the map in my Rand McNally Road Atlas that I keep by my bed and read almost nightly. That's a lie, but as a kid, I read it almost nightly. It is still by my bed, though. I've looked at Alaska, and one reason I love maps is because I like imagining what it's like there. I see a town surrounded by vastness or mountains or a river, body of water, and I wonder what that town looks like. Well, I've wondered about all of Alaska. Well, now I've got a reason to go to Alaska. Because about a year ago, my nephew took a job as a volunteer at a radio station in Nome, Alaska. He graduated from UT and just wanted to get away from academia for a year, go off the grid, and so he found this volunteer job at this radio station as far away as you can get from humanity in the United States, Nome, Alaska, on the Bering Sea. So I thought, I've always wanted to go to Alaska. What a great reason to go. I've got somebody to visit there.
Sure.
I did the math the other day. Alaska was the 43rd state I've been to. So I've got seven to go.
That is pretty good.
I have never been to South Dakota, Iowa, Nebraska, Delaware, Rhode Island, Connecticut, or Maine.
You can count up my states. I know. The 43, though. That's pretty good.
I haven't counted my states either. I think it's probably only five.
Previously, yeah, you've only been to Texas and Mississippi and whatever's in between, which right. is only one state.
Oh, really? Is it only one state? Dang.
My previously favorite states to visit were Colorado and New Mexico. Mm-hmm. Those have always been 1 and 2 or 2, 1, 1, 1A, however I rank them. I love those two states because, as you guys know, I love the mountains. Alaska is my new number one.
Really? Wow.
Alaska is by far the most beautiful state I've ever seen. It is by far the most mountainous state I've ever seen. To put it in perspective, Alaska makes Colorado look like the Texas Hill Country.
Wow.
And Colorado's famous for all of its 14ers, 14,000 foot peaks. That's nothing in Alaska. Alaska has tons of 15,000 foot peaks, 17,000, 18,000 foot peaks that don't even get any attention because of Denali at 20,000 feet.
Wow.
And everywhere you look, it's just an endless chain of snow-capped mountains. The beauty is unbelievable. You get near the coast and you have these fjords and the Bering Sea
Chevys.
And glaciers and snow and beautiful greenery, and it's just everywhere. And Alaska is massive. It's, of course, our largest state. You can fit Texas, California, Montana, and all of New England in Alaska.
Man.
Holy
mackerel. The three biggest states plus New England, and you have room left over after that. That's how big it is.
Yet only 1,200 people live there.
It's very sparsely populated, yes. By the way, I wanted to mention this. The radio station that my nephew is working at, KNOM in Nome,
mm-hmm.
just like the ticket, they've won three Marconis.
Really?
They have?
Yeah, and he gave us a tour of the station, which we'll get to when we talk about Nome here in 15 minutes, but in their display case, when you walk in, they're a very highly decorated station. They've got their three Marconis right there. Yeah, isn't that cool?
Well, that cheapens our accomplishment.
So our family has six Marconis.
Are they Alaskan sports talk? What's their...
They're religious, George.
Way okay. to go, George.
I didn't know. I was just guessing
way
format.
Religious radio
to go.
Station.
No format better than another one.
So we flew to Anchorage. You can go nonstop DFW to Anchorage. And we met my nephew in Anchorage, so we drove to Denali immediately. It's about 220 miles from Anchorage to Denali, but it takes about 5 or 6 hours. You can't get anywhere in Alaska quickly. As I mentioned yesterday, there are no interstates. Everything's a two-lane highway pretty much, and there's a lot of slow traffic. There are tons of campers this time of year, RVs, so the going is slow, but the scenery is so beautiful, you kind of don't care.
Yeah, that's okay, right?
Didn't mind it at all. And I've always wanted to go to Denali National Park. It's the biggest of all national parks. It's bigger than New Hampshire.
Good Lord.
Wow.
It is... The scope of it, you cannot really even understand. The beauty of it, I will not do justice this morning, but I've wanted to get to Denali because I've always wanted to see Denali. Formerly known as Mount McKinley, formerly known as Denali. It was named after the president-elect McKinley at the time, and then just a few years ago, the name was restored to its original Denali. The white man renamed it, and we probably never should have. Well, here's the catch. When you go to Denali National Park, did you know only 30% of the park visitors ever get to see the peak? It is so
shrouded in clouds.
So massive, it creates its own weather system. So it's almost always hidden. And that was a really frustrating thing. So we had the drive up on Friday. We had two full days in the park on Saturday and Sunday, and then the drive back on Monday. And here, the thing that I've wanted to see the most all my life is the highest peak in North America, over 20,000 feet, Denali. And the frustrating, ironic thing is, the biggest thing in North America, you can't see. You're so close to it, and you can see everything else, but the biggest thing there you can't see. And it drives you crazy after a couple of days if you don't see it. So on the first full day, we decided to do our own hike, and we drove our own car in. And with Denali, there is one road in and one road out of the national park, and the road is about 90 miles long, and it goes right into the heart of the park.
Two-lane
dirt.
Oh,
you can. The first 15 miles are paved, and that's as far as you can take your own car. And if you want to get really into the park, you've got to go on one of the park buses. So the first day, we just drove our own car in. We spent some time at the visitor center, took in everything, did our own hike, about an 8-mile hike up this really cool peak. You have spectacular views, but it was kind of weird knowing that there's so much more of the park out there that we can't even see. But on that first day, it was kind of cold and rainy. And by the way, I posted a few pictures from the trip on Instagram. I'm at Junes Miller, I believe, is my Instagram handle.
Is there a question mark at the end of it?
No, okay. No question mark. Just at Junes Miller. I posted 4 or 5 pictures from the trip. I'm going to post a bunch more after these segments of some of the great views. But the first hike was spectacular. The weather was kind of chilly and rainy, but that made it more mystical. And it was a lot of fun, but we couldn't see Denali. The second day, we decided to go deep into the park because it's a commitment. You're riding basically these old school buses on dirt roads, and the drive in, we didn't go all the way to the end of the road. That's about an 11-hour round trip. We went to the Eielson Visitor Center, which is about 60 miles in, which was about an 8-hour round trip on this bus. But again, the scenery is so spectacular, you don't really care.
And is the bus packed?
Yeah, it's pretty packed.
Bunch of smelly prospectors on it or what?
No prospectors, mainly tourists.
Okay.
And so the second day was all about the bus ride. And what's interesting about Denali is that it is so huge, and my brother-in-law they visited my nephew about a month ago, my sister's family. My brother-in-law put the proper word on all of Alaska, but especially Denali, untamed. The whole thing is untamed. Mm-hmm. And it's so untamed, there are no hiking trails. There are a couple right in the beginning on the area you can drive and park, and off the paved road you can do your own hike. But when you get into the park, the place that the bus takes you, there are no hiking trails. So every once in a while, someone would say, can you stop right here? And the bus driver would stop and then open the door, and a family would get off, and you just start hiking over the tundra.
Wow.
And you create your own hike. You see a peak you want to hike, and you just start hiking it. And you're out there with the wildlife, and the bus driver, if a bear has been spotted in the area, will not let you off. So you're left to your own accord when you're out there, and you better have some bear spray or whatever you're going to carry. And a lot of people, you can camp in certain parts, and you just do your own thing. It's the most untamed, unruled national park I've ever been to.
What's the most common kind of bear up there?
Grizzly.
The big one.
So as we're driving along in the bus, we're seeing wildlife. We see moose.
Yes.
We see caribou. We see Arctic squirrels.
Caribou.
We see golden eagles. And we saw 5 grizzly bears.
Whoa!
Now, we were always on the bus.
Right.
And it's here where I started to...
The bears weren't waiting at bus stops, were they?
No.
In disguise.
Okay. We were catching the bears in the wild, and they say only 30...
Fedora and sunglasses. Yeah.
They say only 30% of the park visitors get to see the Denali Peak. Well, not that many really get to see grizzly bears. I believe there were about 600 grizzlies in the entire park. 300, and this is a park the size of New Hampshire, keep in mind, or bigger than New Hampshire. So you're not guaranteed to see any of this wildlife. One park official said, if you're expecting this to be the Serengeti of the North, it's not that. It's they're out there, but they're not plentiful.
Mm-hmm.
So did you say there's only 600 bears in that?
In the entire park, grizzly bears.
The size of New Hampshire.
Larger than New Hampshire.
And you saw grizzly. 5.
And we saw 5. We considered ourselves incredibly lucky.
Yeah.
The first one, the park, so, you know, if the bus driver said, if you see some wildlife, yell stop. And so we're driving along and stop for a caribou, stop for a wolf, stop for a moose. And then someone says, stop, grizzlies. And we look over there and they're about 150, 200 yards away. Everybody's got binoculars. And you see three golden grizzly bears and they're just foraging, roaming around. And they are awesome to see in person.
I bet.
Now, were they all adults, or was it like a mom and two cubs?
The first three were all adults. The second two that we saw on the return journey was a mom and a cub.
Mm-hmm.
And they were closer. They were about 100, 150 yards away. It was great.
Finally get to see a mama bear.
It was at this point that I started to entertain myself. And I was the only one laughing at this on the bus. Even though I made the joke out loud a couple of times. No, I started entertaining myself as bear spray misuse guy. And so I said to some people on the bus, once we spotted the grizzlies, hey, do you want me to run out there and squirt him in the face with my bear spray? Being the guy who doesn't really understand the meaning and the use of bear spray. No. It's not when you spot a bear. You don't run up to the bear 200 yards away and blast him in the face with bear spray.
You're marking him.
I also made that joke a couple of times when we were hiking and we would stop to eat lunch and the Arctic squirrels will come up right to you. And I said, should I blast one of them in the face with my bear spray?
Gosh.
They want food. And I figured, you know, if I give them a good blast at point blank range, because they'll come up and stand on your foot.
They'll laugh because they know it's a prank. I mean,
they won't laugh.
Foxes think it's funny.
So I really enjoyed bear spray misuse guy. Nobody else did, but I got a big kick out of it.
I always thought you sprayed your hair down with it before you went out into grizzly territory.
Not a bad idea.
So, yeah, we got to see grizzlies, which was just really awesome. Great hike that day. We got out to the visitor center, 60 miles into the park. Great hike. We would have had a spectacular up-close view. At this point, we're about 30 miles from Denali's summit. And it would have been a great view, but the peak was shrouded by clouds. At one point, before we left that visitor center, a little slice of it opened up. And you got... You only saw maybe 5% of it, but you got an indication as to how big it really was. And that just seeing that slice was mesmerizing. It's this huge hulking mountain and all these other peaks. So for 2 or 3 days, we've been saying, God, I wonder if that's Denali. And then we'd kind of look at the map and try to figure it out. And no, that's a 5,000 foot peak. Denali's 20,000 feet.
Whoa.
But it was so hidden that we kept thinking an 8,000 foot peak, maybe a 10,000 foot peak, a 7,000. That we thought that might be Denali. And eventually we learned exactly what it looked like, where it was, and how hidden it was, and how massive it must really be.
So how many vertical feet of Denali are being obscured here?
It has the greatest vertical rise, I believe, of any of the tall peaks on Earth. And I believe it's something like a 6,000 to 7,000 foot vertical rise.
Mm.
That's being hidden, but you're seeing all the peaks below it.
Right.
Well, we go back to the lodge we were staying at, and we met these people at dinner that night.
Generic.
And it was an older couple who'd been there on a tour, and we were telling them, yeah, we didn't get to see the peak of Denali, and we were really upset about that. And the man pulls out his phone, and he starts scrolling through some pictures, and he gets this half smile on his face, and he goes, well, guess what? I got an ace in the hole in case we don't see Denali. And I said, oh, okay. Because I think I had mentioned that my nephew said that we could see it from the air. You know, when we fly to Nome, you fly right over Denali. And a lot of times the peak's above the clouds. So this old man says, I got an ace in the hole in case my wife and I don't see it. And he walks over to us and he shows us this picture that he took from a plane of this peak above the clouds. And I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, that doesn't look like Denali. And then his wife says, honey, that's Mount Rainier. And he goes, I know. And I didn't say it to him, but I wanted to say, how is that your ace in the hole for Denali?
It looks something like this.
It doesn't make any sense. Why are you showing me
this? I got an ace in the hole. Drawing up a mountain on a cocktail napkin.
Yeah, right. He was so that. Proud
it
of this.
Something like this here.
So it just that really beat me down.
No, I think you're jealous because he had a big ace, in the hole.
You don't have an ace.
He's a total ace hole.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we spend at Denali National Park, the most beautiful national park I've ever been to. I told you guys about my trip to Big Bend a couple of years ago. That's an incredible experience. Every Texan should go to Big Bend National Park. Everybody, every American should support our national parks. 3 days at Denali National Park. Didn't see Denali, the summit. I really wanted to see it.
Failed trip, man.
So on the drive Monday, we're driving back to Anchorage to put my nephew back on the plane to Nome. And as we're driving along, about an hour into the drive, my nephew says, because we've been looking for Denali the whole drive back, my nephew says, look at that peak over there. That kind of looks like the summit of Denali. And I glance over, and I'm so skeptical and beaten down at this point.
He said, that's Mount Rainier.
Yeah, I said, no, that's one of the lower peaks. Yeah, Rainier. And then we all kind of take a triple take at it, and then we realize, oh, my God, that's Denali.
The angels started singing.
After 4 days, it's showing itself. And we pull over, and a couple of other people had pulled over at this lookout. And we all scramble out with our binoculars and cameras. And there it is. And I'll post a picture of this later today. There's the peak. And we see Denali.
Wow.
20,000 plus feet in its glory. It's clear. The skies have opened up. And then we pulled into the next two. They have these official Denali turnout points where you can view it. And there it is, and everybody is so happy to finally be seeing it. Everybody was giddy, not
awesome.
Just us, but all the other tourists that were finally getting to see
it.
And
it stayed clear for a while? You could see it?
It stayed clear for probably the next 2 hours.
Dang.
It was really a joy to see the highest peak in North America, and the trip was complete at that point.
That's great.
I wanted to tell you about the other national park we visited, which was Kenai National Park. Kenai Fjords National Park, which was in the southern part of the state. So after we put my nephew on the plane to Nome, we drove down to the Kenai Peninsula, which was absolutely beautiful. We've run out of time in this segment because I want to spend some time on Nome here in this next segment. I'll tell you about Kenai and the glaciers and Kenai Fjords National Park and just the scene down there in the southern part of Alaska. Spectacular. And the incredible 4th of July that we had in Seward, Alaska. I'll do that on Thursday around this time.
4th of July in the most beautiful state?
In the most beautiful state, and I went to Kenai Fjords National Park. I spent the 4th of July in a national park, and that felt very patriotic.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
It was really great. I'll tell about Kenai Fjords on Thursday. But coming up next, I've got to tell you the story of going to the end of the earth. All right, in the midst of telling you about some of my trip to Alaska, spent 10 days in the 49th state, the last great frontier here in this country. Spent last segment talking about the trip to Denali National Park. Spent a few days down in the Kenai Peninsula, which I'll tell you about later this week. But then made the 90-minute flight from Anchorage to Nome, Alaska. That's where my nephew has been working as a volunteer at this radio station, KNOM. Three-time Marconi Award winner, just like the ticket. He's been working there for the last year, and his tenure is up in just a few weeks. So we knew we had to visit him before he left, and we knew we wanted to go to Nome. I've always been interested by Nome. Very, very tiny city, town, really. On the coast of northwestern Alaska, right on the Bering Sea. It's been featured in a couple of commercials for like Die Hard battery or some kind of antifreeze because typically it gets down to 20 below, 40 below. It's gotten as cold as 60 below there. Air temperature, not wind chill. And, you know, it'll show the car starting in that kind of cold.
If a Die Hard can start your car in Nome, Alaska.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's one reason my nephew chose to go to Nome, because he wanted to go off the grid for a year. And just he's a city guy. He wants to live in London or New York. He's from Austin. He likes the big cities. He's into urban design. That was his major. But he wanted to see how the other half lived for a year, to go to a town of 3,900 people, as far off the grid as you can get, Nome, Alaska.
What was that winter like?
You know, he said it wasn't awful. It doesn't snow as much as you think because they're on the coast, but it does snow a lot. The coldest it got was about 22, 25 below.
Oh,
he said most days were 0 to 10 degrees. It wasn't god awful.
Okay.
Well, the first thing you notice is that you don't often fly direct, even from Anchorage to Nome. You have to stop in a town called Kotzebue. And as we're getting on the plane with a bunch of other people that were mostly locals, we started talking to them, and they said, this is called the Milk Run. People in Kotzebue, which is even smaller than Nome, and Nome and the little settlements around those towns, they have to go to Anchorage for their groceries. Kotzebue and Nome have grocery stores, but everything is super expensive because it costs so much to get products to these little towns that once a week, once a month, once every couple of months, you'll take a couple of giant containers and you're allowed to check three of them, I think, for free, or two of them for free, under Alaskan law. Because so many people have to make what they call the milk run. So you'll get on this Alaskan Airlines flight, you'll go to Anchorage, you'll load your coolers with produce and everything you can't really find in Nome or Kotzebue, you'll check it as luggage, and you fly back to your town, and that's how you get a lot of your groceries. Isn't that a crazy
that
way to
crazy
live?
Wild.
Started talking to some of the locals about the local high school sports, and Nome has a high school basketball team and a cross-country team. They don't play football there, I don't believe. But I asked, well, what is the district? And they say, well, we play Kotzebue, and we play Wales, and we play Barrow, Alaska, which is the very northern point.
Yeah.
They fly
Barrow
to
Wheels.
Every single district game.
Wow, that's kind of huge.
Yes.
That would make you feel legit.
Some of them are 30-minute flights. Some of them are two-hour flights when you go up to Barrow. That's their district, is all these other little towns scattered hundreds of miles away in Alaska.
What's the Nome mascot? The Gators?
Now, I'm not sure. I didn't find out. I need to look. So you land at the Nome airport, and you feel like you are landing in the middle of nowhere. The airport is the tiniest airport I've ever been, and I'm not making this up. You stand in the middle of the Nome airport. Five steps this way gets you to the checkout counter. Five steps this way gets you to luggage. Five steps from your center point will get you to security. And five steps from your center point will get you to greeting the passengers who are arriving. You are, if you stand in this one spot in the airport, you are five steps away from everything you need in that airport. Well, Nome exploded around 1900. In 1898, I believe it was, population was 90. In 1899, population was 30,000. Because they struck gold. The three lucky Swedes, they are the ones that originally struck gold. Then word spread. Everybody from California came flooding up to Nome, Alaska. And everybody for the first year lived in tents on the beach.
Beaten.
Tell me that's not beaten. In 40 degree below weather. And so it was called Tent City. And then my nephew told me the story of how Nome got its name. And when the English were first charting that area, trying to make a map of the coast...
I say, Reginald, let's make a map.
The area didn't have a name, and so the guy who first charted that region, there's a little point, a little cape there, put question mark name, N-A-M-E, question mark name. Well, a few years later, when someone else got that map and returned to that region, they read it as C. They read the question mark as a C somehow, and then they read the A as an O. So they thought the guy meant Cape Nome, C for Cape, and then Nome. They didn't see it as question mark name. So it became known as Cape Nome, and then when the town popped up, since that was on Cape Nome, they called it Nome.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Well, now that we know the mistake, though...
Should we go back?
Yeah,
go back
we need to naming it.
So my nephew picks us up, and as we're driving around town, it's pretty much as I thought. It's
sausage fest.
It's very it is more so. You know, we'd always heard that the male to female ratio in Alaska was 5 to 1 or 8 to 1, and that was the case when the oil boom happened, and I think certainly when the gold boom happened, where you know, everybody's going there, men mainly, to mine and to work or to work in the oil fields. Well, it's evened out more. In Anchorage, you didn't really notice it, but in Nome, you did. There seemed to be many more men there than women. And as the local women say, or at least they used to say about finding a man in Alaska, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. And you do find people that are a little left of center in Nome. I'm not talking politically. I'm talking about just in life. They're a little left of center. You got to be a little left of center to live there. One of those is the mayor of Nome, Richard Benville, who my nephew has gotten to know because my nephew is a reporter at this station, so he interacts with the mayor a lot. He knows the mayor so well that on our next day in Nome, we got a tour, a five-hour tour of the town and surroundings from the mayor. He's 72 years old.
Why?
He's exuberant. He was in theater. He was on Broadway. Somehow he made his way to Alaska, and he quit his job in the school system. And a few years ago, he ran for mayor. He won. And his catchphrase is "Hello Central." So he picks us up at this museum. By the way, Nome has a spectacular museum. It's unbelievable. There's this. It's almost like a shanty town, but you have this modern day museum, which is just one of the greatest museums I've ever been in, about the history of Nome and the gold mining. And then you have also this modern day hospital. It's, I think, the number one employer in Nome. It's this huge, incredible facility. It's a research facility. It's a clinic. It's great. So the mayor is driving us around this town, and as he picks us up at the museum, he walks up to us and he goes, "Hello, Central." And I'm thinking, why is he calling us Central? I don't understand that. So as we're driving around, he'll turn down a street and he'll say, "All right, this is our main street. Hello, Central." We're driving through the countryside. Look over there, some musk oxen. Hello, Central. And
what
as we're
heck?
Walking around the wilderness, he'll say, "Hello, Central, blueberries." And I asked him, I said, what is this "Hello, Central"? He would say it every 2 minutes. He said he grew up as a kid in New Jersey, 72 years old. And in New Jersey, when you used to make a call, you would call the central operator and you would say, "Hello, Central, connect me to so-and-so."
Mm-hmm.
So that became his lifelong catchphrase. He must have used it 10,000 times.
I've never heard that before.
"Hello, Central."
Never have either. I would have liked it better if you would have said, what's the story with that? He goes, "What? I'm not saying hello, Central. What are you
saying?" Yeah. Well, as the female member of the traveling party.
Oh, that was you, huh?
Perfectly observed. She said, "Nome is very Mad Max." And that was the most perfect description ever, because first of all, it's almost all dirt roads. It's very Spartan, very utilitarian, as I mentioned. This is a picture of a typical street in Nome, Alaska.
It's kind of beaten.
Yeah, that is a little beaten. Hello, Central.
Yeah.
It's real beaten.
Hello, Central. Now, picture this. Picture that type of street setting with just beaten down homes and dirt roads. And most people get around. Most of the cars you see are sitting in driveways with flat tires. Most people get around on four-wheelers.
Mm.
Now, tell me that's not Mad Max.
It's real Mad Max.
So it's either a dirt bike two-wheeler or a four-wheeler, and they make a lot of noise. The occasional truck that's really heavy-duty, you know, huge tires, real Mad Max-ish.
And everybody's dressed like they're in The Clash.
Yeah, kind of. There are guys going around on the front playing guitar real loud with the amps cranked up. And as she also observed, there's all sorts of junk in people's yards of that hark back to a time where there was a lot of life. But there's all this old, beaten down, like broken down cars and junk, and everybody just collects junk because I guess there's nowhere to throw it away.
Sounds a little bit like Mississippi.
Sounds okay, a little bit like Mississippi.
We're talking about Alaska here. Let's stay on that state.
They do have, and I want to get to this later. I've got so much to say about this state and this trip. There are some of the locals, some of the indigenous people who have a really bad drinking problem there. And adding to the Mad Max feeling, they walk around 24 hours a day up and down the main street like zombies.
Right.
And it's really...
The indigenous do?
Yes, and it's really unsettling. Not all of them, but most of the homeless or drunk population there, they're just wandering around and their eyes are kind of glazed over. And we were in a bar one night and a couple of them just walk in. They look around, they walk up to you, they stare at you, they don't say anything, then they just walk back out.
So they're indigenous,
maybe too. They are zombies.
So it's Mad Max.
Indigenous.
Yes, exactly. So it's a very Mad Max setting. However, it's also one of the greatest towns I've ever been to. And I found at the end of the 2 days in Nome, I could live in Nome. There were so many cool people that we met, not the least of which the mayor. Hello, Central. There's this one great coffee shop there. You would think you're in Austin with the people who come into the coffee shop. And sometimes these huge guys with tattoos and huge beards come in, and I'm starting to fear for my safety. and then they order an Earl Grey tea with a little splash of cream, and they start talking about world news and something, and they're super nice as they head out to the oil rig or the gold digging platform or whatever. There's one great restaurant there, and I swear to you guys, the meal was as good as any I've had at any five-star restaurant in Dallas.
Wow.
The food throughout Alaska was spectacular.
Did you eat anything strange, like moose or...
Reindeer sausage. Very Nolan Ryan. I had reindeer sausage.
You smoked some reindeer sausage up there?
And they've got this state-of-the-art hospital and the state-of-the-art museum, and the radio station that my nephew gave us a tour of was spectacular. Nice people working there. They do great things. And so there's this real soul to Nome. And I think because they're off the grid, you have to fly to Nome. You can't drive there, like a lot of cities in Alaska. Did you know Juneau, the capital, is the only capital that you can't drive to in America?
No.
There are no roads that go to Juneau. You have to fly or take a boat
to roads.
Juneau. Yeah. That's how all of Alaska is. There are just hardly any roads in the entire state. And I've always thought... I can live anywhere because even in Nome, the people find their nice coffee shop, their nice restaurant, a nice group of friends, and you make it work. And Richard, the mayor, hello Central, gave us a tour of the countryside, and he took us out into the tundra.
I've never
appreciated tundra before. You look at it and you think it's just a bunch of weeds, and it's what pops up when it's not covered with snow. But he said, no, come on out here. And we walked the tundra. And it's really squishy. There are no trees inside at all. It's just flat green. And he said, look at this. These are blueberries. They grow in the tundra. But you have to look really closely.
What kind of blueberries?
He said, look at this.
Love those butt fucking blueberries.
Gosh. That just needs to be perched.
He said, look at this. It's an orchid. And when you get down on your knees and you look at the tundra, it's not just weeds. It's fruit. It's orchids. It's these incredible flowers that you only find... in Alaska, and it's this whole other world, this ecosystem. And
he was really hello centraling out there.
Oh, anytime he found something new, it was hello central.
It's the orchid man.
And then I gained this new appreciation to a point where I didn't even want to walk on the tundra anymore. And he said, don't worry about it. Reindeer and bears do more damage to the tundra than we'll ever do. There's so few humans out here. But that was really interesting. And Nome is so close to Russia as well.
Yeah.
So you get out into the tundra and you can see for miles and you can see across the Bering Sea, and in the distance on the land in that part of the, it's called the Seward Peninsula where Nome and Kotzebue are snow-capped peaks. So they've got pretty much everything there. Just across the water is Russia. Nome, I think, is about 90 miles from Russia, but I learned this. I didn't know this. Did you know that our two countries are 1 mile apart?
I knew they were close.
I didn't know it was that close.
There are two islands, the Diomede Islands. Diomede is United States property. Big Diomede is Russian property, and they are separated by a strip of water that is 1 mile wide.
They inhabited either of these places?
Both of them are inhabited by the indigenous people, not by Russian or U.S. troops.
By the zombies?
By the zombies. Did you have any idea the United States and Russia were 1 mile apart?
I knew
it was
close.
That's a fun fact. Why don't we know that?
We should all know that. But yet, I was blown away to know that.
Wow.
I also wondered, because the gold rush put Nome on the map, I wondered, well, people have been living in that area for thousands of years. Eskimo, by the way, is getting to be a pejorative term, although they still use it there. There was an Eskimo recreation center. It's now you now call the natives by their
Inuit.
Well, there's that, but that isn't even used too much. It's now their specific tribal name.
Oh,
their old tribe names. You're supposed to use that. Anyway, I said, well, why didn't they find the gold? They could have been rich beyond their wildest dreams. And Richard, the mayor of Nome, said, social relevance. They found it. It meant nothing.
It didn't mean anything to them. They don't care about gold.
It didn't have any meaning or value whatsoever.
According to George, they can't drink it.
To the native culture.
I didn't say that. So
isn't that an interesting thought? That they're standing on all this gold, they're digging it up all the time, but it means so little to them, they have no idea that it's valuable until...
They didn't care.
The white man comes.
I want to know what a gold is.
It was...
That sounds like a great trip.
One of the most incredible experiences of my life to see a town like that, a United States town, but so far off the grid, such a unique place, such incredible individuals and countryside and this Mad Max feeling of end of days and what it must have been during the gold rush. It was just, it was an experience of a lifetime. And my awesome. My nephew's been living there for a year, and he loves it so much now. He doesn't really want to leave. His volunteership is up here in a couple of weeks, but he's gotten into his routine, and he has discovered and observed the beauty of it so much that he almost doesn't want to leave now.
Why would he want to leave? He's just winning Marconi's left and right up there.
I know. They're killing it.
He's crushing
killing
it up there. He's crushing it.
So I've got so much more to tell you from my trip to Alaska. I want to talk about the native people. I want to talk about nature. I want to talk about the Kenai Peninsula. We'll do all that later in the week. But right now, I want to get back to some more stories from my summer vacation trip to our 49th state, Alaska. And I spent some time on Tuesday morning telling you guys about a visit to Denali National Park, and then the last stop on our trip, which was Nome, Alaska. And the reason for going to Alaska, in case you weren't with us on Tuesday morning, well, two reasons. I've always wanted to visit that state. I've always been fascinated by Alaska. So far away, so massive, so many mountains, so many small towns that are hard to access. But in this last year, my nephew took a volunteer job in Nome, Alaska at KNOM Radio, and so that gave me a reason to go visit. I had somebody in Alaska to visit. By the way, we have quite a family history in the state of Alaska. Not only has my nephew now spent a year living in Nome, and my sister's family went to visit him back in May, and I went to visit him a couple of weeks ago. Did you know that my dad was also stationed in the Navy in Alaska on Kodiak Island for 18 months?
I did. Right. I did. Your dad told us those stories when we were in college.
Yep. Said
that to go visit him.
It was so cold. They woke up every morning drinking Mississippi mud coffee just to get warm. And
yeah.
So he had, in fact, a couple of Christmases ago, we broke out his old slides from his time at Kodiak Island in the Navy. It was really great to see that.
That's where my brother was in the Coast Guard. He loved it there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Kodiak Island.
Yeah. How do you not love it? I know you're there for the military and you're working, but it's so beautiful. As I said on Tuesday, I've always loved Colorado and New Mexico. Those have been my favorite states to visit because I love the mountains. But Alaska is more beautiful than those states. Different beauty, you know, New Mexico's that high desert and Colorado's the beautiful Rockies, but Alaska feels like Colorado on steroids. There are snow-capped peaks everywhere, and so we got to experience that at Denali National Park, and then we took my nephew to the Anchorage Airport. He had to go back to Nome to go to work, and we had another 4 or 5 days to explore the Kenai Peninsula, which is the southern part of the state, not all the way southeast, where you go into Juneau and where most cruise ships go. The popular cruise to Alaska starts in Seattle or Vancouver, and then you go up the Inside Passage, as they call it, through southeast Alaska, through those mountains and that coastline, and Ketchikan and Sitka and Juneau. And I've never been down there. I hear that's beautiful. But the Kenai Peninsula is further up the coast. It's due south of Denali and of Anchorage. And so you go another 2 to 3 hours south. And there are a couple of cities there that we wanted to visit. And the first one was Homer. So that was the one day where we had a really long drive starting at Denali, make the pit stop in Anchorage to put my nephew back on the plane, then continue down to Homer. That was about 8 or 9 hours of driving. I was ready to be done with the drive on that day. But you get down to Homer, Alaska, and it's at the bottom of the Kenai Peninsula, kind of towards the west. And Homer's a little town, population of about 4,000. They have something called the Homer Spit, which is a very thin stretch of land south of Homer, juts out 4 miles into the bay. And the bay there is Ketchumak Bay. And they're famous for their oysters and seafood. The spit is very touristy. They've got a lot of little touristy restaurants and shops there. And then they've got a port, a harbor. Well, the next day, we took a water taxi across the bay about 30 minutes to Ketchumak Bay State Park. And we did a hike that day up to the Grinwick Glacier. And this was the first time I remember being that close to a glacier. I believe I've seen a glacier in Europe. I think when I lived in Colorado many years ago, I saw St. Mary's Glacier, which is about an hour west of Denver. But I don't really have any vivid memories of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll put some more pictures of the glacier on Instagram after this segment so you can see the view that we saw. But it was really spectacular. You make this 3-mile hike up to a lake. You're just dropped on a beach. And there's a trail that takes you up to this lake. And then you see this glacier. And you see this lake in front of it and the giant blue icebergs that have broken off the glacier and they're floating around.
Wow.
And it's really spectacular. Have you guys ever been up close to a glacier?
No.
Never seen one.
Never been close.
It's a river of ice, basically. And almost every glacier in the world is receding. There are cases of glaciers increasing. And John Muir, who is the father of conservation in this country, truly a great American. I read a lot about him on this trip. He's an incredibly interesting individual. And he knew more about glaciers than anybody probably to this date. And so he was all over Alaska. He loved going to all these different glaciers. But it was really cool to sit there and to hear the calving of the glacier. You'd hear a piece break off or those icebergs that are floating in the lake. Suddenly a big chunk will fall off and it makes a really loud, dramatic sound. Very cool. And then from there, we would hike down to another beach and the water taxi picked us up there and took us across the bay, but still in the state park region, just across a little bitty bay.
To beach have sand on it?
It was real rocky. Mm-hmm. It was mainly rocks, not a whole lot of sand. And the next stop the water taxi took us to was a place called Halibut Cove. Not a city, a community. Not a single car in this community. And the boat driver lived there, and he said, we have 120 residents. Only 12 stay through the winter. So we have 12 year-round permanent residents. And all of the homes are built along the cove. And
what market number is that?
It's market number 1 billion. And to get around town or the community, you either have to go by boat or boardwalk.
Nice.
The boardwalk links the one restaurant there, which was spectacular, as good as any restaurant in Dallas.
A DQ?
There's no DQ. You have this one great restaurant. You have a couple art galleries. You have homes. You have one little store. And it's all linked by boardwalk. And it was...
Wait, they have an art gallery?
Yeah.
What does a town that size need an art gallery for?
Well, this woman who found her way, I think because her family had land in Halibut Cove, she found her way there. She had studied art in the 60s in France, and she did art. Her drawings and paintings were done of squid ink. And
that's what she used.
That's what she used.
Squid ink.
And she became this world famous artist, and she opened her own gallery there, and it attracted a couple of other artists. And I got to tell you,
can't get much foot traffic though.
I got to tell you, definitely not in the winter, but in the summer, a lot of people come across from Homer, although there weren't many people there when we were there, and it was mm-hmm. July 4th week. But if you were an artist or you wanted to go somewhere to write a book, that would be the place. No cars, clean air, a lot of beauty, the mountains and the water. It was really,
it's a good place to go and get on Twitter and just stay for a few months.
I don't know about getting on Twitter.
That's the point of going there.
You can get on Twitter anywhere.
Gosh.
So that was our time in Homer, and then we drove to the other town that was recommended to us on the Seward Peninsula, and on the Kenai Peninsula. The Seward Peninsula, confusingly, is where Nome is, but on the Kenai Peninsula is where Seward is. So we drove to Seward,
named for Seward's icebox.
Right, is that right?
He was the one who put together the purchase of Alaska.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
And he was there at the Ford Theater that night that Lincoln was shot.
Ooh.
Did you know that?
No.
He was injured in the melee.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
He survived. And then, yes, correct. He organized the purchase of Alaska from Russia. Mm-hmm. Boy, and we got it for like a nickel on the dollar.
Yeah, did we have like 2 bars of tobacco?
Yeah, something like that.
Some baubles.
So, yeah, Seward was kind of genius. And there are a lot of things, the peninsula and the town named after him in Alaska. Well, Seward was really interesting. My sister had been there the month before, and she said, "Nah, there's not much to Seward." Well, we arrive in Seward, and it's this great little town on the bay. And the first thing we do when we get to Seward is take a whale-watching cruise. And we go out on a little boat. It was for 6 people, or for 8 people, I guess. There were six of us and 1 captain.
So if you got too close, that whale could launch you.
Yes. And we got pretty close. You go out and you start looking for whales by looking for the spout. And the Captain Nick, had great eyesight because I couldn't see anything, but he would say, suddenly he'd floor it. And he'd say, I saw a spout over there. So we're out in this bay, and there's some other boats out there looking, and they're kind of watching what the others are doing.
What kind of whales are we looking at?
Humpback whales.
Okay.
And they were about 40 feet long. And it was so cool when we would get close to one, because you'd wait, and then suddenly the back would surface, the blowhole would become obvious, and they go, they would blow out.
Wow.
Suck in and then go back down. And they would do that about three times in a row, and then they'd take a huge breath and then the big dive, and you would see the whale tail come up and then That's go hot. Back in. It was great. And they were this bluish purple black color, mm-hmm. like a color you only see in nature. It was really interesting.
Did you get nervous when they would go out of sight?
Not at all.
Thinking that maybe they were lining you up down there.
Yeah, going to breach.
I asked him about that because there were some kayakers close to us. So I said, has a whale ever eaten a kayak? And he said, no, not that I know. He said, maybe it's happened, but I've never heard of it out here. So we followed several whales around. We saw probably five.
Wow.
We saw sea otters, and we saw sea lions. And the sea lions are gigantic, and they're laying up on rocks sunbathing and fighting with each other.
It's such a bad design.
Terrible.
Their bodies are just so awkward looking.
So smooth in the water, but when mm-hmm. they get on land, they can't do anything. No. Saw a bunch of birds. There were a couple little islands, and it reminded me again of my claim that birds outside of the flying thing are incredibly spare.
You can't, there's no such thing as birds outside of the flying thing.
Outside of the flying thing, they are so spare because they peck at their food, they have no arms, and they just sit around. And this island...
Cheap-looking feet.
Yeah, cheap feet. And this island was full of bird dung. It used to be black rock, but now it was covered in white bird dung. And they're all just standing in their own dung.
They don't care.
They don't care.
Mm-mm.
And it smelled...
Doo-doo birds.
Great to see whales. Really enjoyed 4 hours out on the boat. That was a lot of fun. And then...
Were you allowed to spear them?
No.
Okay.
Gosh.
That bothers me, too, just the whole whale hunting thing. And the whale doesn't know it's coming. It surfaces just to get some air, and then a spear is thrown in its side.
Teaches him a lesson. Don't doesn't be up here breathing our air.
The next day in Seward was July 4th, and we had heard that Seward, population 4,000, would swell to about 30,000 on July 4th because it's the best place to go in Alaska, apparently, for July 4th. Well, we woke up that next morning, go down to the city center, and there's a lot happening. There's, you know, food vendors, street vendors, booths selling knickknacks and whatnot. I think Shorty DeFazio was there. And I saw that celebration, and I said, hello, Central. We're on to something now, right? This looks like a time. And it's centered around the Mount Marathon foot race. Now, I used to run a lot. But I'd never heard of this race, the second oldest race in America behind the Boston Marathon.
Hmm.
It's got to be an old race that they call it a foot race.
This was the 92nd running of the Mount Marathon race. And I'm seeing how big it is, and I start to read about it that morning, and I'm thinking, how could I never have heard of this? Because the list of winners has a lot of really famous names, including Kilian Jornoe, who's the most famous distance runner in the world right now. And I texted one of my buddies who's a big ultra runner, and he goes, I can't believe you're there. I'm so jealous. That race is epic. It's world famous. They do a lottery, so only 350 runners are allowed a year. I think there's a field of 350 men, 350 women. It's not a marathon. You run up Mount Marathon, which is the mountain that hovers over Seward.
Mm.
So it's a total of about 5 kilometers, 3 miles. First mile and a half, you leave the city center and you start almost immediately going straight up to the top of Mount Marathon. It takes the runners, the elite runners, 35 minutes to go a mile and a half.
Whoa.
Mm.
That tells you how steep it is. I think it's like a 30% pitch. They're going straight up. They're basically climbing, rock climbing. And I noticed at the beginning, a lot of the guys didn't look like normal marathon runners, you know, skinny 120-pound guys. They were a little
more built, and they looked like more like football players. And it's because it's kind of a full contact race going up the hill, and you're pushing and shoving, and then coming down the hill, you're going so fast you wipe out a lot because it's so steep. So the runners coming back into town, the winner did it in about 45 minutes, 5K in 45 minutes. That tells you how hard the race is. But almost everybody coming back into town was covered in dirt and blood.
So, from town,
you could see Mount Marathon, so you could see them going up the side of the mountain like ants going up a hill. And then you could see when they were coming down the hill, there was a trail of dust behind the runners. So it's a really cool visual. And they had, while the men were up fighting it out on the mountain, they had kids races. 6-year-old, 5-year-old, 4-year-old, 3-year-old, 2-year-old.
What?
And the 2-year-old race was so wheels off. You know, the gun would sound, and then half the kids would start crying. The other half would run to their parents.
Go the wrong way.
Yeah, going the wrong way. It was really funny.
Like those baby races.
Yeah, those are funny. So that was the morning. The afternoon, we decided to go to Kenai Fjords National Park, which is right outside of Seward. And I thought this was very patriotic. We went to a national park on July 4th.
Indeed.
I felt like a really good American doing that. And this was the second...
I did that too. Went to Clyde Warren Park.
That's not a national park. This made the second national park of the trip, Denali National Park in Kenai Fjords, and that made my 14th national park that I've been to.
Wow.
Now, there are 59 proper national parks, so I've got many to go, but I love going to national parks.
We went one together.
Yeah, we did. Grand Canyon.
And wasn't that Everglades thing that we went to?
That's correct, yeah.
That was a national park?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Where you tried to push George into an alligator.
No, but those Japanese people were getting really close to the alligators. Whoa.
They were taunting the alligator, and you're not supposed to do that at national parks.
No.
You're not supposed to identify them as Japanese.
Well, they were.
You're not. You don't know that.
But they were speaking it.
How do you know what Japanese
is? Yeah, you don't know.
I do. No, you don't know. I guarantee it. Okay, you can think you can identify Asian languages.
Yes.
If I had 10 people in here with 10 different languages.
Yes, I could tell you exactly.
No way.
Oh, whatever.
No way.
Oh,
you can tell cameras.
Crazy.
So we went to Kenai Fjords National Park, and the big attraction there is Exit Glacier. And there is a very famous hike that you do there, and it's up the side of Exit Glacier. And if you want to keep going, once you get to the top of the glacier, you go another mile and a half to the Harding Ice Field. And in the visitor center, they build this as going back to the Ice Age. This is what it looked like back in the Ice Age. Mm. This is a leftover ice field from the Ice Age. So we decided we're going to do the whole hike, which was a 9-mile round trip. Here's the interesting thing about the glaciers and glacial retreat. When you drive into Kenai Fjords National Park, I didn't understand what I was seeing at first, but I saw a sign by the roadway that said 1842. Then we drive a little further and I see 1868. Drive a little further, 1898. Okay, park, go to the visitor center. Get our passes, get our hiking map, and then we start the hike. And then I see another sign that says 1919. And then it dawns on me, those are years, and that's where the glacier was in 1868.
Mm-hmm.
Then it had retreated to that spot in 1898, then that spot in 1919. And you have to hike another mile before you get to the glacier where it is today. And so in just that 100 years, it had retreated something like 3 or 4 miles. It's a little disturbing, but and I don't know, I don't have the numbers on this, but I'm assuming that glacial retreat is happening at an even quicker pace now in the last 100 years. But it has been happening forever, and as John Muir noted in his research, the first glacier that he found and fell in love with, he noticed that in like a 4-year period or 10-year period that he went away and then came back, the glacier had retreated 4 miles. And that was before the combustible engine. So glaciers retreat without man-made global warming or climate change. I'm assuming they're retreating even more rapidly now.
Yeah.
That would be my assumption. And it's really sad but it's a part of life and evolution, and it's the world, and we're not in the ice age anymore, and so glaciers are going to retreat. But I would advise everybody to see a glacier when you can, because they are things of beauty. They are ice rivers, and they're among the most beautiful things I've ever seen. And again, I'll post a couple of pictures here in a moment, but they're just the colors and the size and the sounds of them cracking and calving. It's really something to behold.
Yeah, they all have that blue tinge to them?
Yeah. And that's really special. And it's apparently where the water is, the ice is denser, that's even a darker blue. Mm-hmm. So we hike 2.5 miles up, beautiful hike, and you're seeing the glacier off to your left. And then you get to a point where you're really close to the glacier and you're overlooking the glacier. And we ate lunch there. Then we had 1.5 miles to go to the top, the Harding Ice Field. And we start that last 1.5 miles. Almost the entire 1.5 miles was a hike through snow. In Man, July.
That's freaky.
You're hiking through snow, but it was worth it. It was about a 4-hour hike from bottom to top, but when you get to the top and you're standing there, and I've already posted that picture of me overlooking the Harding Ice Field on my Instagram account, by the way, is @JunesMiller. And that was a really surreal moment to be looking out at this ice field where it feels like you are back in the ice age. And for miles, all you can see is this sheet of ice.
Wow.
White all around, and these peaks poking up occasionally from the ice field. And it just gave you the perfect silence, you know, and this surreal setting. It was really, really a special moment to be up there and seeing that. Came back down, took, you know, another 3 or 4 hours to get down. And what a great July 4th that was, to see the celebration in Seward and the Mount Marathon race. By the way, I got on the plane in Anchorage a couple of days later, and I see my buddy John from Dallas, and he's a guy that I've ridden with and run with for years. And I said, "You were up here?" And he goes, "Yeah, I did the Mount Marathon race." I said, "You did? I was there watching. I was on the start line. I can't believe it. If I had known someone I knew was in the race, I would have been cheering you and looking for you. I couldn't believe
it." How many people are allowed in that race?
350. He got in on the lottery.
Oh, man.
350 people in the world are in that race, and you knew one of them.
Isn't that crazy?
That is nuts.
So, yeah, that was our time in the Kenai Peninsula and Kenai Fjords National Park. And the whole peninsula is just breathtakingly beautiful. You have water and snow-capped peaks. And you have... there was one really great moment where on the eve of July 4th, they do their fireworks there at midnight because that's the only time it's dark enough in the summer in Alaska. Mm. So everybody was waiting for the fireworks. And we took a walk along the bay in Seward, and it was the campgrounds. And there were hundreds of campers, people who'd come in from all over Alaska to celebrate July 4th in Seward. And I noticed something as I was walking along the path there, and everybody was around. They had all these fire pits, campfires, fire pits, people barbecuing, and there were all these lawn chairs out and kids playing. And we walked probably a mile through a mile of this. And I finally observed, I haven't seen one person on a cell phone. Everybody's sitting around these fire pits. They were talking to each other, and the kids were riding bikes and they were playing tag, and people were sitting around.
So they were all on landlines?
No, they weren't on landlines. No, Gordon, you don't have to be on a phone.
How were they checking Twitter? I don't understand.
And so I kept walking and walking, and I noticed no one sitting around with their family or friends was on a phone.
Yeah, nobody was having fun.
And I just thought that was such a beautiful July 4th present, that yes, there still are parts of this country and events in this country where we look each other in the eye and we talk to each other and we can get away from our personal devices for at least an evening and just celebrate each other.
That's great. That's
pretty cool.
I've got many more stories and observations from the trip to Alaska. One of my favorite trips ever. I want to talk about the Inuits, the indigenous people, and their treatment over the years. And I've got a lot of hot sports opinions on that. I've got more opinions on conservation and glacial retreat and things like that that we'll get to in the next few weeks. But a couple of stories for you from Alaska.
Nice.